So hi everyone, nice to meet you. So yeah, today I'm going to talk about this subject, which is based on a paper with Aharoni, Benigni, and Milan, and some undecided number of papers that are supposed to appear somewhere between half a year ago and in half a year, I hope, I mean the next month or two. Because of the way this this thing happens, I'll mostly describe the results concerning that, and I'll towards the end, I'll move to the new stuff that we had. So hopefully you haven't heard most of it before and won't bore you. Let's maybe start with what is the question we are actually trying to address here, which is as follows. So this whole thing is should be, okay. So the question we are trying to ask is as follows. We are trying to understand how do different geometries appear in quantum gravity via the perspective of some microscopic theory. Which means that we will assume holography, so we will work with the concrete holographic theory, n equals 4 super young Mills, and we would make a thermodynamic computation. On the one hand, we will compute a partition function on the gravitational side, and on the other hand, we will compute a partition function on the CFT side. Now, the conjecture of holography, right now it's no longer conjecture, it tells us that the two should be equal. However, there are very different ways of computing them. So on one hand, the partition function on the gravitational side is something a bit tricky to define. I mean, you can define it in the whole string theory. We don't usually do that. So we would like to think about it as some path integral over all metrics, which satisfy some boundary conditions, maybe not just metrics, but metrics and some other supergravity fields. That's, of course, not a well-defined quantity. However, practically, the way we compute that is that we do some saddle point approximation. So we assume that we have some G Newton, we assume that it goes to zero, and we assume that we can look at the saddle points of this path integral plus the fluctuations around it. So we find that this is some expansion in which we have a contribution from each kind of solution to this, to the equation of motion that's come from here. Specifically, in our context, and I'll define it more carefully later, what we expect is to find e to the minus the action of some black hole, perhaps with some quantum fluctuations around it, which are G Newton effects, perhaps with some other kinds of fluctuations, plus e to the minus S of, let's say, thermal ADS, which is another kind of solution, a saddle point solution to these equations. Again, maybe with some other kinds of corrections around that, and so on, and maybe some other kind of semi-classical solutions. And generically, for the CFT partition function, it's a very hard object to compute. You can sometimes it's weak coupling, sometimes it's strong coupling. But generically, it's very hard to compute it exactly. What we will do, however, is concern ourselves with the very specific setup in which the boundary conditions we put are supersymmetric. So the gravitational partition function will still be computed in this way. However, the CFT partition function will be, we will be able to compute it exactly. So I will, in a moment, define what actually, okay, so I'll just write it now formally as e to the minus beta h minus some beta omega I ji minus beta yi. So what I mean by that is that I'm just computing a partition function with possible chemical potentials for each of the charges in our theory. My charges would be, I'll mention them in a moment, okay? So the reason I'm presenting it in this way is because this is how the holographic dictionary works. It maps thermal partition functions to thermal partition functions. However, I told you that I want to compute some supersymmetric quantity, which means that I'll have to somehow pick out my chemical potentials such as this way, such as this kind of partition function would become an index, meaning it will have the form raise minus 1 to the f times e to the minus beta Schrödinger q plus some additional stuff. Okay, so I will, what I'll tell you in a moment is that I'm going to choose my chemical potentials in a specific way such that my partition function will have this form, and then it will have an exact way of computing it because, well, essentially because it's a concern, it's a quantity that does not depend on the coupling. It's a supersymmetric quantity, and well, tell me if you want me to explain that, but it will just be a quantity that is that I can compute at weak coupling and trust at strong coupling. I'll do that in a moment. The reason I'm telling you all of that is because we have a way of computing this quantity, which is again exactly the thing that you should match to gravity, by some tricky technical manipulation. So the way to compute it will make it to become a sum. So it will be a sum over several contributions. I call them right now IR. I will explain what they are. But the whole point of all of this introduction is that this IR, which becomes just a sum, gives me a bunch of terms. Each one of these terms gives me a bunch of terms at any finite n. And when I expand each one of these terms as n goes to infinity, I will get exactly this kind of contribution. So each one of the terms in this expansion would give me, at n goes to infinity, exactly one of the saddles that I see in the bulk. And when I say exactly, the point is that it's not just that the scaling of the saddle would be the same, it's not just that the scaling of the action would be the same, but the coefficients themselves would match. I will be able to actually more or less track down how at large n each one of those contributions appears in the gravitational computation.
Are those saddles of the gauge integrand?
No. There are some manipulations by which you can get them as a saddle point approximation, but the point here, I will go through that, but the point is that this is not a saddle point approximation in the way I will present it. It's, if you want, it's a computation of residues. I will get to that. Maybe the nice point here is that everything is here should be exact at finite n, and I take the large n limit only at the end, much to the gravity side. And the structure we will describe does not depend on large n in any sense. So the whole point of the lecture will be to match these discrete contributions on the CFT side to a bunch of contributions on the gravity side. Now, you may ask, why do we want to match everything besides the answer that we can? And the reason would be that when you match leading stuff exactly, you are able to then ask questions about subleading corrections. So for that, let me, again, very hand-wavingly, just describe what I mean. I will use the holographic mapping, which tells that G Newton, or 1 over G Newton, is n squared, where n is the rank of the gauge group on the holographic side. And on the holographic side, I will have three kinds of contribution. One contribution is going to go like e to the minus n squared times some number. This will usually be a new geometry that appears. It's like the contribution of a black hole to the partition function, or the contribution of thermal ideas. Well, not thermal ideas, but another black hole, stuff like that. I will also have contributions which go like e to the power minus n, or if you wish, e to the power minus n compared to a contribution like that. This usually comes from deep brains, okay? In string theory. This is how the action scales. And there would be all of these kinds of order one contributions, which I will not care about at the moment. What we are about to see is that in order to match the, so first of all, so this is a deep brain on top of some gravitational background. Okay, this is the scaling. Naively, would think that if I want to compute something in gravity, all I need to take care of is the gravitational effects. And all of the deep brain's effects are going to be very small. One of the interesting parts of this work, I think, is the idea that in order to exactly match the index and exactly match the QFT result, and match it at any kind of parameter of position in parameter space, meaning for every kind of chemical potential, you cannot just take into account these effects. If you would forget about the fact that you have these extra brains or these extra objects in your theory, and you try to naively compute that and then go to another region of parameter space, you would find not only a divergent result, but a result that would have some other kinds of ailments. For example, it would not give you the kind of periodicity you expect from your theory, your partition function, which having, okay, I'll explain it in a moment, but effectively it would mean that if you try to ask what are the charges that exist in the microscopic theory, you would not see them quantized in the correct units. So again, the whole, after this 1 hour, I hope to convince you that you have this kind of expansion on the gravity side where you expand over different bulks. You have some expansion on the CFT side, and at the large and limit, each one of those goes to each one of those and actually sees all of these kind of weird, non-perturbative and subleading contributions, both of other geometries and of other objects. All right. So having said that, let's actually define what I'm talking about. Right. So what we will be concerned with is, again, computing such a partition function. We'll compute it for n equals 4, SUN, super young Mills theory. Okay, and this theory has five charges, essentially. It has two kinds of angular momenta. These are J1 and 2. They are essentially the isometries of S3. Maybe I should write and compute the partition function on some S1 times S3. So it has two kinds of angular momenta, and it has three kinds of global symmetries, what we call R charges. Write it. Here is Q. So it's Q of 1, 2, and 3. Okay. And we can put down a chemical potential for each one of those charges in order to compute the partition function. However, it turns out that there's a, so generically we would find a partition function that looks like that. However, then it turns out that there's a nice feature for the matter content of this theory, which is that if you compute the fermion number of something, it's actually equal to, here it's just the times one of the charges, meaning that for each one of the, for the matter content of this theory, the fermion number is correlated with like one of the flavor charges, R charges theory. This allows us to do the following trick. So we write down our partition function of beta minus beta h minus beta omega I qi I minus beta qi. And we massage it in the following way. So we write it now as trace e to the minus beta h minus j1 minus j2 minus some qi. So all we did here was to massage the theory. Define it like that. So all we did here was to massage the exponent here such that we have it written like that. And now we notice that if we choose to write things in that way, then this quantity, the one that we write here, is essentially, if we choose things correctly, and we'll define it in a moment, this thing is just the commutator of a supercharge and its complex conjugate on the sphere. Okay, so what we get from here is just trace e to the minus beta q dagger q minus all the other things that are written here.
Super naive question related to your previous remarks about exploring the parameter space of chemical potentials.
Yes.
On the gravity side, when you take a large limit and you start traversing the space, do you see any Stokes phenomena in the index of discontinuities that get smoothed out when you look at the exact CFT expression?
Yes, and we will mention that. So the whole point of writing it in this way is that we can write now our partition function in this way, being a little bit sloppy. And then we can choose one of the chemical potentials, specifically the last one. We can choose it to satisfy some constraints. So generically, if we just look on some manifold, we cannot preserve a supercharge. However, you can ask, can you put down a background for your chemical potential such that you will be able to conserve a supercharge? That's essentially asking, is there a well-defined spin order? I think I'm being way too technical here. But the main idea is that if these chemical potentials preserve some condition, then you can define a supercharge on your curved space. And then this relation happens. It turns out that this particular condition, which essentially means that beta times 1 plus omega I minus pi A equals 2 pi I n. So whatever, if your chemical potential satisfies some kind of relation like that, then you can define a supercharge on your manifold. And moreover, if you choose this n to be 1, then what happens is that you can define phi 3 using all the other variables, and you end up with the following kind of trace. So all the manipulations we have done are just to get into this kind of term, which I will write as, I'll define these things in a moment. So sorry for that. So the only reason I have gone through all of this work is in order to say that if I choose a specific combination of chemical potentials, then my thermal trace now becomes a trace with e to the minus 1 times 2R3, or in other words, it has e to the minus 1 to the power of f, which means it weights bosons and fermions with opposite sign. Okay, so all of this annoying work that I did, and now I figure out that it's much easier to do it with slides than on the blackboard, is just so I could refer to my partition function, my thermal partition function, the thing that maps naturally to gravity, as an index, as something in which the contributions of fermions and bosons cancel. Okay, why do I want to use it as an index? Again, I'm sure most of you know, but it's just because if you have an index and you change the couplings, then your supersymmetric states can come either as bosons or as fermions, but they don't have to come in pairs. These are short representations. If you change the coupling, then they must be lifted in pairs, therefore the long representations. And if you count the something with opposite signs for bosons and fermions, you're only sensitive to like the vacuum. You're only sensitive to like the short representations. So essentially, you are independent of the coupling. Doesn't matter that much. All right. So that's just so that whole work is just so I would be able to write my equations in that form. Now, one important thing about writing the equations in that form is that now I know what is exactly the relation between the chemical potentials or the fugacities that appear in the index. Maybe let me write it a bit more clearly. So this was e to the minus beta qq minus, let's call it just tau. Write it that. So this is now my index, practically. It's also J2, let's forget about it. Now I know how to map these parameters, these chemical potentials, from the index computation to the gravity side, right? And the reason I know to do that is that I know how, in general, to map chemical potentials from the index to the gravity side. Specifically, there are two mappings I want you to remember. Let's talk about, okay, so let's notice two properties of this partition function, okay? These two properties are going to be important because they will give us all kinds of gravitational saddles in a moment. So what we computed was a partition function of e to the minus beta h plus beta omega I, j, I, and so on. The charges in our theory are quantized. Specifically, in these units, the QIs are quantized with, should be half QI, never mind. The J's are quantized with half units, and the QIs are quantized integer units. What it practically means is that our partition function, Z, is independent under shifts of the chemical potentials by 2 pi I over beta. So Z of, let's say, omega I phi I beta is the same as Z of, let's take omega I to okay. So we have this kind of periodicity in our partition function. This periodicity in the partition function, well, it's an inert thing that comes from the quantization of the charges. I'm mentioning it now because we'll see that it here on the gravity side, thinking about things as a space, it appears naturally, just function of the quantization. Over on the gravity side, it will have a weirder kind of way in which it appears. These kinds of shifts are also relevant for the phi I. All right.
So let me, yeah. You reduced the number of chemical potentials when you went from the full.
Right.
To there, is it possible to see, when you interpreted it in gravity, could you see like the G Newton correction sort of being truncated when you specialize to
No, I do not know how to see it. How different things vanish on the gravity side. That's mostly because I've only worked in supersymmetric setting on the gravity side, because otherwise I would have had nothing to compare to.
But when you interpret such an object that you compute in the field theory, in the free field theory, and when you specialize with regards to the chemical potentials to that, is it possible to see the G Newton correction sort of?
No. The reason for that is that, well, maybe it is possible. On the gravitational side, things become way more complex if you don't assume supersymmetry. So, for example, you have nice, well, we'll see in a moment that on the gravitational side, the action, the charges, the energies all have very nice expressions in terms of the charges, the chemical potentials, if you assume supersymmetry. If you don't assume supersymmetry, then the action does not have a nice expression in terms of the chemical potentials. It's just a very horrible function of it. But I feel like I'm a bit too scattered, so let me maybe gather things around, define the gravity side, and then show you what I mean by that. Okay? So if you got nothing out of that, forgive me, but the main idea is that we can recast the index as a partition function, which is the object that maps naturally to the holographic side. Now, let's ask ourselves, what are the solutions we should sum over on the holographic side? These are all the different geometries that have the same kind of boundary conditions. What boundary conditions? Again, those that are specified by the chemical potentials we have described. Specifically, on the gravity side, what we will look at, for simplicity, is a theory, let's say, with a metric, five-dimensional metric, and one specific gauge field. This is like the gauge field for the R symmetry in bulk, which is in the same multiplet of G Newton. The boundary conditions we are going to set are such that A mu, the boundary condition of A mu, are going to give us the chemical potential for the R symmetry. Specifically here, I am not looking at the most general thing. In the paper, we do a bit more generally. But in the setup I've written here, the idea is that next to the boundary, A mu should become something like phi 1 plus phi 2 plus phi 3 in the time direction. Okay, so this is like the boundary conditions for A mu. In addition, we have chemical potentials for the angular momentum. And you might want to ask me, how do they appear on the gravitational side? And the way in which they appear on the gravitational side, I will not derive this, is that we are going to have some non-trivial identification for the coordinates, meaning we are doing a Euclidean computation. Our boundary is S1 times S3 because this is the gravitation, this is the UFT partition function we are describing. So naturally, when you have S1 times S3, you would identify the imaginary time with the imaginary time plus some beta. However, when we put down chemical potentials for the angular momenta, we don't have this simple kind of identification, but we have a weirder kind of identification. So you have two different angles inside our ideas. These are, if you want to think about it, these are like angles for the, so these are just, well, you think about ideas, seven radial coordinate, time coordinate, and the sphere. And these chemical potentials for the angular momenta just tell you that you have to have some twist identification, which means that as you go around the thermal cycle, you also shift the two angles. Okay. The details don't really matter, but the main idea is that you have this kind of twist. And the reason I'm even saying this twist, even though it looks like a very technical thing to say, is that it will play a specific role in a second. So the boundary conditions we have described tell us that at infinity, the gauge field should have some form. And in addition, that this twist should happen at infinity. Okay? And now we would like to find all of the different geometries that satisfy these kinds of boundary conditions. It turns out that there are geometries that satisfy these kind of boundary conditions. There are some asterisks there. I will mention them at the moment. But you can ask what is the action of, let's say, a black hole that satisfies that. One way of, again, I'm not sure how many of you are interested on the gravity side. So you can have a Euclidean solution, which asymptotically has this kind of wheel. Sorry. Which has this kind of weird identification. And that.
It's a Mac.
So you can have an identification, a Euclidean solution that satisfies this kind of boundary condition. And you can ask, is it supersymmetric or not? And the answer would be that it's only supersymmetric if it satisfies a condition that is similar to the one we have found on the CFT side. Okay. So in the same sense as before, we get exactly the same constraint, or almost exactly the same constraint. Specifically, it means that one of our chemical potentials is determined by the other. It would be convenient, though. Yeah.
The black hole solution that satisfies the
So the Gudovsky real black hole is a Lorentzian solution that is supersymmetric. If you want to talk about Euclidean, that's the model, sorry, that's not in ours. So if you want to talk about Euclidean black hole solutions, you have to complexify things. Why do I say that? So Lorentzian black hole solutions have two features. They are supersymmetric, which means that due to their algebra, you have some relation between their energy and their charges. Let's assume that all the angular momenta and all the R symmetries are the same. So you have something like that. That's one relation between them. On the other hand, you're going to also have some kind of weird relation, nonlinear relation between their charges. Between their charges and angular momenta. This is like essentially two constraints for here three variables, so you won't have anything to play with. In order to get Euclidean solutions, you have to complexify things, then you can keep this relation but not have this relation, and then get to the and then after you've compute everything in this complexified setting, then get to the real setting. Really sorry for doing that, but I will not like to hang on to the complexification thing. It's a whole story that is not ours and it won't really matter. So let's assume that we can talk about complexified metrics and all of that and analytically continue everything and believe the results. The main idea is that you can do your computations on some real slice and then analytically continue. So, wait too long. All right. So let me just tell you what is the actual on-shell action, what is the actual contribution of such a black hole, okay? I will use the same parameters that I've introduced before. So I'll have some chemical potentials, which are essentially the same as the one I introduced on the gravity side, and sorry, on the CFT side. And in terms of them, so they are determined by my boundary conditions. And in terms of them, this specific black hole that I have told you about, this specific, more or less, Gudovsky-Real black hole, would have an action that goes like pi I n squared. And this is, again, in terms of G Newton, which is 1 over n squared, times this notation, phi 1, phi 3, phi 2, phi 3, divided by tau squared. So I'm using here equal chemical potentials for the two angular momenta and different chemical potentials for the out charges. I'm sorry, I tend to do it more carefully. But that's essentially the contribution to the action that we get. So that's the leading piece, specifically with a specific coefficient. Okay. Now I have told you that from the CFT side, I should have some kind of periodicity. Specifically, I should have this periodicity, which in my correct variables would translate into tau, should be the same as tau plus one. Okay. This is, well, this is this shape, more or less. Well, where it in the, it's tau plus two, but never mind. Due to this constraint, it holds. However, you see that the action I have written here, so the on-shell action, or rather I should say, on the gravity side, what I would get is that when I compute the partition function is a sum over saddles, so I would get this thing in some exponent plus some other saddles. And if you plug here tau plus one instead of tau, you would find that this partition function is not periodic. It does not have the same structure as the thing we found in CFT. So there must be new solutions which somehow make it periodic.
Sorry,
sorry.
It's pi I.
Pi I, yes.
So my question, Euclidean gravity.
Euclidean gravity, sorry?
Well, how do you get the
here? It's more or less due to the variables they used. So there's a superfluous amount of I's here in the relation between the chemical potentials that I've used and these new ones that I've defined solely to agree with like conventions from the CFT side. I'm sorry. And everything here is complex anyway. But that's essentially the form you get.
Is there some complex conjugate saddle?
Yes, there's even more than complex conjugate saddle. So we can ask, how do I see this periodicity come about? And the way you see this periodicity come about is to remember that what we have demanded is some kind of twist at infinity. However, even at infinity, I can redefine this parameter omega. I can redefine, in this language, I can redefine omega 1 to go to omega 1 plus 2 pi I, plus, 2 pi I over beta. And what it would do is that it would shift this identification by 2 pi. However, shifting an identification of an angle by 2 pi just gives you the same kind of identification. So I could shift a parameter, this kind of parameter in the bulk, find a different metric that depends on this parameter, find a different action, however, satisfy the same boundary condition, okay? Which tells me that if I almost have to do that, then I actually have a whole set of gravitational saddles that satisfy the same boundary conditions. However, in the bulk itself, they look different. So I don't have just this kind of saddle. I will also have a saddle that looks like pi I n squared to the third tau plus one squared plus tau plus two plus something that goes like tau plus three. So these are essentially the different black holes that have the same identification at infinity. However, their bulk, their metric in the bulk is a little bit different. Okay? In a sense, if you know this story from ADS3, And I'll say it quickly, so sorry for not giving explanations. In ADS3, you have a torus at infinity when you compute black holes, and you have a family of different BTZ black holes that contribute to the partition function. These different black holes are given by the fact that the torus, which is just S1 beta times some S1 angle, so this is like the thermal cycle and this is like an angle. When you compute it in ADS3, you can choose which cycle to complete into the bulk, which cycle to close. And closing different cycles gives you different bulk geometries. And in order to compute the actual partition function for ADS3, you need to sum over all of these different geometries. Similarly, here you have this parameter tau, which corresponds to the topological twist that you have. And you can essentially choose which kind of cycle on the boundary you close. And these different choices, close meaning as you get to the horizon, as you go into the bulk, one of those cycles has to close. And each one of those choices gives you a different geometry, and therefore you should sum over all of them. Okay? What this thing does, practically, is that it gives you this periodicity in tau, this periodicity in the chemical potential that I talked about. The way it does that is that as you shift tau to tau plus one or tau minus one or whatever, a specific black hole just moves into the contribution of its shifted counterpart and so on. So you just have a bunch of contributions, and as you shift a parameter, they just shift together. Okay? So such that the overall partition function is periodic. Right? So that's one thing.
That's one. Circle, right? That
you have the trajectory that just goes up, or the trajectory that winds one, or winds y. Yes. You can also say it with like theta angles and so on.
Yeah.
Spectral shift. Yeah, exactly. So what you see here is that gravity somehow naturally implements this kind of thing in order to reproduce the periodicity of the partition function.
So just for the time that I talk a bit, because I know that this literature is huge, we are probably talking about some new stuff. So we started defining some indices in CFT.
Yes.
That are defined by whatever we can compute, right? So these are
yes.
indices that we sum over
yes.
supersymmetric studies that we can compute. And now you are saying that in gravity there are some black holes that Andrea was mentioning, you the name of, some complexity
mm-hmm.
version of those black holes. That will describe some states that we should sum the gravity sum.
Right. So
plus their twisted images to get all this stuff.
Yes. So one thing. Okay. So we'll.
So far we're two different subjects that eventually will merge. But
yes.
And what is already known? This index problem was already defined. And so
everything was the problem was defined earlier on. So the index was known. A way to compute it was our collaborators in a previous paper that found a bunch of solutions which I show with agree with that. The original black hole was known. However, all of these shifts the complexification parts of this part was more or less known before we started. The fact that you have all of these shifts and they're allowed to take is something from our paper. I'm going to talk about so all the shifts, or like the thing that was known before our paper was that the specific form of the gravitational solutions, that they exist, but not that you can take these shifts, and the idea that the leading saddle reproduces what you see from the CFT side. So these kinds of things were known. The effects I'm going to describe right now, which is different geometries and different d-brains that you can see on top of these, and the fact that these different d-brains are going to determine which solutions you have to take, so which geometries you're allowed to take, this, I think, was not known in the, well, especially not in the context of n equals 4, the context of this work. And perhaps it was found out in some other ways in other contexts. But,
Could we have tried to compute just the bulk of the gravitational function? I mean, this is a supersymmetric observer.
Yeah.
Should just take the supergravity and try to look at the gravitational function? That for some of the points.
Yes.
That's how also the will come into approximation. But
yes.
You can find some bidirectional
right.
link or something.
Yeah, so you could
that
do.
That is all approximation, it will give you that. I mean, you could compute within supergravity directly if you're able to localize that.
So, okay, so effectively, what we find is localization in supergravity. With some of our saddles, they are supersymmetric, and I will tell you in a moment.
The word supersymmetric configuration is not necessarily a saddle point.
Right.
In the
I agree. So
in get very common. I mean, a supersymmetric configuration doesn't have the equations of motion. So.
Right. I agree. Okay, so maybe two things about that. One is that we don't know how to, or I don't know how to do localization in the bulk. We don't know how to localize supergravity. It comes from two reasons. So it comes from two reasons, or one reason especially. When you localize, you need to give some metric. Well, specifically in this case, we didn't even try. But generally, you want to. Sometimes you have like some. In other cases where people have tried to localize in the bulk, this is like Drucker et al. And the bulk. Whatever, another paper, they found like a manifold of supersymmetric solutions.
Yes.
And they had to assume somehow what is the measure on this manifold. And they had an answer for that.
The measure is computable in principle. Is that
no, terminal? I don't think it's computable. I don't think it's computable because you don't even know what is the original measure in supergravity. You don't really sum over all metrics. You have another, I mean, that's just what we say, but it's not a well-defined concept. I mean, I
think the issues are UV issues.
Yes.
And usually for this supersymmetric observable, you can compute them, forget about UV issues, because the counter terms that you would have to add do not contribute to this observable anyway. So if you just look at the theory of another model, it will capture the right dynamics. The thing you have to control over will not affect this observable, essentially.
It could be the case. I don't know. I know that people have tried to do localization in the bulk for these kinds of quantities. I know that they haven't succeeded. So maybe it's a way to do that. However, the benefit of this approach is that, I will say that all of these contributions just come in that exact form from the CFT side. The CFT side is after localization and some other manipulations, but they just come in the same form. So maybe there's a way to compute it like from first principles in the bulk.
Yes.
However, this is also a correct way and it works. And moreover, okay, so maybe I'll say it right now. So if you do localization in the bulk, if you do localization in general, so you have some parameter, well, you have some whatever, so path integral, you have some small quantity, let's call it whatever t, and you have some q exact term, so this is what defines your localization, you'd expect that the result is independent of t, or in a sense, it only has like three, only has whatever contributions that are exponentially in t, maybe plus one loop effect, right? One loop effect, but one loop effects are independent of t.
Yeah.
So the way to write it is something like that. You'd have some order one coefficient times some exponent. And there would be a sum over these exponents where the exponents are like the different prefactors of t that exist for each saddle. Okay, that's like what you generally expect from a localization result. Specifically in the context of gravity, let me write. Let me write this as just t plus order one, something that does not depend on t.
What is the exponential of number times t? I mean, the supersymmetric configuration of the side of the QB vanishes. That's the infinite.
Yeah, but that's like the instanton effect. So, if you do localization, you have like the one loop effects around each particular supersymmetric loci, but you also have like non-perturbative effects that could come in generically, right? And they would be suppressed. Yeah.
The main is technical, but the contributions do not, the act does not depend on the by definition.
I agree. I agree, but you do have other configurations which are exponentially suppressed compared to the first one. Okay. We can discuss it later. But all I'm saying is that even if you had localization in the bulk, what you would expect is a bunch of exponents which scale like n squared plus corrections to them that truncate at one loop. Okay, so we'd have here terms that are up to order one, order n to the zero, and you wouldn't expect any order one over n corrections. So you wouldn't expect anything like that? Yeah, okay.
No, that's the point. N is not the same as t. I think you're confusing two parameters.
You're right. I'm sorry. You're all correct. I'm sorry. What I meant is that I have here some n squared times some s classical. Sorry. Okay. So what I would expect is a bunch of things that scale like n squared.
The action of the classical solution may be in some way, I don't know.
I agree, but suppose it looked like that, like in gravity, it certainly does look like that. I have 1/g here, right? So I have like the classical piece plus the one loop effects that come from that. So all I'm saying is that if you had localization in the bulk, you would expect to have a bunch of saddles whose exponents scale like n squared, like 1/g, plus the one loop corrections around them with no further one over. Okay.
Do you have some t dependence that comes in because you have some stuff at infinity in field space? Is that where?
No. I was mistaken when I wrote this that way. Okay. The gravitational action is not cubed.
I think because you have to integrate over something that you haven't put. You have to integrate over the space of a supersymmetric solution.
Yes.
When you integrate over that space, that would generate a different power of 1/n. That's how it works.
Okay. You're right.
Locus, but I don't think there's any understanding of how to do that exactly.
Yes, that's the problem I was trying to say before. But
for example, like for the inputs to supergravity, I thought it was done for the black holes. My set.
So there are people who try to do it. Again, Drucker et al. Try to do it in another context. I remember we had some issues with the results specifically because we didn't know how to integrate over the supersymmetric loci. Specifically here, I can tell you that what I said right now, that there are no 1/n corrections, that's just true from the CFT side, which I will say in a moment. Meaning, when we match everything, we see that the only contributions you have are exponentially large contribution in n squared, plus order one effects, plus no 1/n effects, plus exponentially small stuff in n. And if it cannot be explained by localization in the bulk, then I don't know what explains it. It's a miracle.
What you're saying is not does not contradict localization at all. I mean, a calculation could easily give you this.
A calculation could give me 1/n correction.
Yes.
Could it give me that if I just have discrete set of vacua, though? Or do I need?
We're not going to guess what the space of solutions of QB is. I have no idea, but.
Okay. But if it's like just localization on specific discrete points, could it give this 1/n corrections?
But that's a big assumption.
Yeah, I agree. I have never said that I am computing exactly the gravitational path integral. All I said was that I'm doing the naive thing on the gravity side, which is doing saddle point approximation in small g Newton. I compute the leading exponent for what happens, and then I match it to an exact calculation on the CFT side. I get some result. And the result on the CFT side matches this naive thing on the gravity side.
You could do that non-saddle point gravitational integral. Mm-hmm. It should give you the saddle point in the Lagrangian expansion.
I agree with that. Yeah. I just don't know how to do it on the gravity side. I do not know how to localize on the gravity side. I do not know how to define it well. And again, it might be true, but I know that other people have tried and failed to localize on the gravity side, in at least in this particular setup, I suppose. So one thing that we get is this all of these different gravitational saddles. I've told you a lot about the fact that we have the brains in this picture. You can ask, where do they arise? Since I have 10 minutes or so, let me just tell you where did they arise. So just like we had this twisted identification that told us that we could take shifts in tau in this twist, we also have a boundary value for a mu. However, this a mu is not a gauge invariant quantity. This is not a thing that maps holographically. What maps holographically is something like the holonomy of a mu. Okay, and here as well, maybe with some light. And here as well, if I shift A, or if I shift, let's say, let's call all this phi. If I shift phi to phi plus 2 pi I, I get this, the exact same holonomy in e to the power of c. So just like with this tau parameter, I should have been able to shift all of these different phis and get different kinds of gravitational backgrounds that all contribute to the partition function that I want to compute. So ideally, one would naively think that I could get the most general thing I could get on the gravity side is something like that, plus different shifts of these phis, so phi 3 plus n 3, phi 2 plus n 2, phi 1 plus n 1. However, you can try to think what would happen in that case, and you would find, so this is. You can try to think what would happen in this case, and you would find that there's a piece that goes like n to the power of 3, pi I squared times just tau squared. Which would mean that for a very large n, little n, so I'm sorry, what I've written here is for n1 equals n2 equals minus n3. So this is a set of shifts that if you would have taken them seriously, would give you a divergence. It would give you that either for very positive little n or very negative little n, the action would just diverge as an exponential of large n squared, okay? Which is bad. This is not a well-defined thing. So you need to have some way of throwing away some of the solutions which would correspond to these shifts while still preserving in some way the periodicity in this variable A. And you better do it in some justified way. And the way we've conjectured that all of this works is as follows. So the way in which you can see that only some of these shifts are okay and some are not, is to remember that this whole solution, even though we wrote a solution in five dimensions, it all lives within string theory. And string theory actually gives you a theory in 10 dimensions. And in this theory in 10 dimensions, you can also have certain brains. Specifically, you can, so your space looks like ADS5 times S5. You can uplift the solution from 5D to 10D, meaning given a 5D metric, like 10D metric that solves the equations of motion plus the other gauge field. And you can see that there are some supersymmetric brains you can put on top of that metric. Specifically, you can put D3 brains that wrap an S3 inside this S5 and an S1 inside this ADS5. And S1 inside this ADS5. So these are like the things that look like giant gravitons. Specifically, they sit on the horizon. And you can compute their action. And if you compute their action, what you find, so what you find is that the contribution of this D3 brain to the action would scale like e to the whatever, n squared times the black hole on which they live, minus m whatever, pi I, maybe with the two here, phi over tau. Okay, so they have an additional contribution to the action, which scales like n, and some ratio of the two chemical potentials. The specific chemical potentials depend on which configuration exactly you have chosen, so which cycles they wrap. Now, the whole concept or the whole expansion that we have made is a semi-classical expansion. Again, not localization. We have assumed that we have small g Newton, we expand around the saddles that we get. Which means that we assume that the brain sitting on top of a classical configuration is like a small deformation or a small change to that action. Specifically, we assume that this is subleading to just this. Okay? I think sign is a plus, which will be important in a minute. So we assume that this thing is smaller than this, okay? Oh, sorry. This thing is larger than this. Which means that since we are working with complex chemical potentials, we have assumed something about the imaginary part of this guy. We have assumed that the imaginary part of this guy is this formulation negative, right? Otherwise, sorry, in this guy, this thing is positive, meaning that the contribution, what I'm trying to say, is that.
So, the brains are supposed to live in the black hole geometry, or in the S5 S5?
In the black hole geometry, the very same black hole geometry.
Found solutions in that.
Yes, Yes. So all I'm saying, So all I'm saying is that we want the action of the black hole to be smaller than the action of a black hole plus a deep free brain. Okay, where this is now just the order n contribution, and this is the exact same black hole. If we don't do that, then it's beneficial for the black hole to like create brains from vacuum, so to say, or for brains to nucleate, and then we cannot even trust the original solution. Okay, so the only solution we are allowed to take are those solutions, on which we trust, are those solutions in which these D3 brains actually increase the action of the solution we are taking, which gives us some condition about the imaginary part, this guy. Specifically, it means that we have to choose a specific phi, and there's only one solution which gives that. Maybe I should say what I mean by that.
So yes. You know how to leave the black hole within dimensions?
We know how to do that. I mean, people knew it before us.
Okay.
We have found these new D3 brains, new Euclidean D3 brains that live on top of it. We have shown that their actions scale like this. And we have noticed that if you take into account the idea that brains are a small fluctuation or whatever, a small addition to the actual contribution of the action, then it gives you a constraint onto which on which geometries you should consider. So you shouldn't just consider the black holes, but you should consider only those black holes which are stable under brain nucleation. Okay? I will explain why, but so the idea is that, again, that's like saying that if you have, in quantum mechanics, if you have some potential and you found a saddle point, you trust it only if the saddle point is like it's a minimum. However, if you found another saddle point and it has a tachyon, you wouldn't really consider, mostly naively, you wouldn't really consider this saddle point as contributing to your action because you have a tachyon, so quantum fluctuation would make this saddle point, I don't know, diverge and go to, and the actual contribution would be from the actual real minimum of the theory. So the idea with brains is the same. It's a non-perturbative object. However, if exciting it or creating it decreases your action, that you'd want to nucleate them. You want to create more and more of them. And therefore, you shouldn't really trust the main saddle point which you've considered. Okay. So you get some constraint on the imaginary part of phi over tau, which specifically means that you have to take a specific shift in phi. Okay. Again, I won't show that. So you have to take a specific shift in phi, and only that shift, is the one that contributes. Specifically, it means that if, in the case of tau, we had some periodicity of shifting this chemical potential, because we had many different solutions that mapped to each other as we shifted tau. In the case of the other chemical potential, we have just one solution which changes because as we shift phi on the boundary, there's only one solution that the bulk adheres. There's only one stable solution it can take. We don't sum over all of them. We just get one of them. And since I ran out of time, let me just say that all of these different things can be seen from the index. So the thing I didn't tell you, due to bad way of organizing this lecture, so the thing I didn't tell you is that all of these features exist in the index. So the index itself can be, So the index itself is a sum over many different contributions. Each one of these contributions looks like, at large n, like e to the pi I n squared, some function of phi. So let me really write it like that. So each contribution to the index looks schematically like that, meaning at large n plus some other thing. So it has a specific choice of phi, okay? It has a specific choice of phi that depends on the choice of tau. It's exactly the same choice as you see from this stability condition in the bulk. It has the same form for the contribution as the one you see in the bulk. And it also has some, it also has some deep brain effects that are the same as the one you see in the bulk. Okay. So you can sort of verify from the superconformal index that these are indeed the solutions you should take, no more and no less. Meaning, if you accept our suggestion that this is the condition that for valid gravitational solutions, then you can match them to the gravity side. What I will not describe in detail is that you can say even a bit more than that. You can see orbifolds in this picture, both on the gravity side and on this side, and match them. Every kind of naive gravitational saddle you can think of, which is essentially orbifolds and black holes with these shifts, can be mapped in a one-to-one fashion to a family of solutions to the index in the Betanzos approach. I have meant to say way more on the CFT side. Poorly planned this, I'm sorry. But that's the picture, and I think that's like the new thing that our work had shown, that if you take into account this condition, then brains plus saddles give you everything you see in the set of solutions to the index. Let me just say that again, it has one interesting feature, which is that all of these different shifts, all of these different brains, all of these different saddles, actually, even though they look non-perturbative and weird and small, they actually give you the periodicity of the index. And the periodicity of the index is essentially the statement that the underlying theory has quantized charges. If you just summed over, I'll just say it like that, and you can ask me about it. So sorry for the mess and thanks.
So there are no one-hour length corrections. There are only exponential corrections.
Yes, and meaning the actual form is that each.
So that a simple interpretation. That would mean that the gravity measure is simpler than we thought before.
I don't know if it's in the measure.
In the measure that doesn't produce.
I do not know if it's in the measure or not. I mean. The measure is like the one loop effect, right? In this sense, the other effects depend on the coupling, so they depend on G Newton, so they depend on the types of interactions. I don't know what it tells you about the measure, but it tells you that the interaction, like for these supersymmetric observables, you don't see G Newton effect.
For circular loops in n equals 4,
you do see
kind of limit when n is large. Do you also get exponential
but also power
law corrections? Or
I do not know. I do not know. What I can tell you is that again, this log of R is just something times n squared plus some plus log of n, which I can explain if you want, plus order one plus exponentially small things for each one of those guys. So these exponentially smalls are the brain, it's just because like you clog off both sides, and that's it. I thought it comes from localization in the bulk. Again, we can discuss this if you localize to discrete points, but perhaps I'm wrong. That statement I can vouch for because it's a specific computation on the CFT side, which you can just do and see that this is the kind of extension. Specifically, since we're computing a very supersymmetric object like an index, you don't see dependence on, let's say, the Tuft coupling, which I think in more involved computations you would expect to see. And sort of pontificate about the fact that if you had all these 1/n corrections in a generic setting, I wouldn't really trust these kind of contributions because they're very subleading. They're non-perturbative ones, so I could ask how to even define them in a proper way. However, I see that here I can just define them because the series truncates.
Can you say some more about what that sum is for the case theory?
Yes, but so I don't want to keep everyone here.
Is that
what's the question?
Limit?
No, this is an exact sum. So, so the way of saying that is that you can have an integral expression for the index, and after some manipulation, you find that this sum comes from the residue of the integral, residues of the integral. Specifically, in order to find the residues of the integral, you have to solve a complicated equation. It has many more solutions than the ones we see, than the one we know of, meaning we don't have a full classification of the set of solutions to these equations. However, there's one family that is very easily seen, and I can argue for why. And there are other new solutions which we have in an upcoming work, which I haven't even gotten to describing. But these simple solutions are the ones that you that I have described here. So essentially, it's the residues for the index in a particular setup, the computation formula. And if you want more details, I'm willing to say that, but it will take like 5 minutes.
The answer is that the complex solution should be a complex solution represent.
These ones?
These ones?
First of all, everything here is complexified because the way to compute all of these things is to complexify. You're asking why don't you have here like that, something like that? Yes, everything here is complex. Yeah, the cells are complex. Well, one way of saying this for why this extra I exists. First of all, yes, everything here, like all of these cells are complex. Indeed, in order to see all of this structure, you have to allow yourself to look at like the complex plane, and then, well, these different cells appear. The reason there's an I here specifically is not that mysterious. It's just the idea that if you had looked at the action for this D3 brain, it would have been in Lorentzian signature, it would have been something like, well, just that over the world volume of the brain, or the action of the brain. And when you weak rotate, you only spit out an extra I if this D brain was along the time direction, or along the thermal direction. And our particular configuration is such that it's not there. So I mean, this extra factor doesn't even come from the fact that we have looked at complex solutions. This extra I factor just comes from the fact that it's a Euclidean D brain that doesn't drop the thermal direction, drops another direction, other directions. So even in a non-supersymmetric, completely real setup, I think you should still see this kind of contribution. There's a term coming from the Jean-Simon step thing, or like term coming from the coupling to the background flux, and the next term that comes from the tension of the D-brain. But again, both of them are coming from like an integral over the world volume of the D3 brain, and again, this extra I factor is just coming from the configuration rather than from the parameters, like the directions.
Is it possible to estimate an analysis for other looking for what should be known?
For other? I didn't hear that.
Just other looking for what you know that do us with a mixture
Yes. Yes. So people have. So it depends on which side. On the gravity side, I think that essentially most of our analysis just carries straightforwardly to any other kind of 4D theory that has an ADS5 factor. So the details of
this IR. The low IR is.
Yes.
Yes. It will model automatically.
Ah, no. No, I don't think so. I mean, people have done some of these computations. Generically, I don't think it should truncate specifically for n equals 2 theories with a not equal to c. I think it doesn't truncate. However, I'm not sure of the details. I think it's.
I don't know.
Yeah, even with things with the holographic dual often. Yes, again, I don't think it truncates for the n equals one theories in general, even though I don't remember the exact details of the computation, so I can look in papers, but I don't know. I can tell you that in 3D, well, 3D it doesn't necessarily truncate, it sometimes truncates in shift variable. Three dimensions.
Yeah.
Like you can repeat some of these stories in different kinds of dimensions. You see a similar thing. The question of whether something truncates or not is a bit subtle. Again, I don't remember the details for the most generic 4D equals n equals one theory. Some of the methods can be applied there, specifically the gravitational analysis and the beta ansatz are known. But I don't think people have computed things, certainly not to this precision for generic 4D n equals one theory. Yes, I don't know the details for that.
I have a question.
Yes.
So, at these exponentials, each of them is a black hole geometry, right?
Yes.
And why don't we have multi black holes and other more complicated solutions?
Well, the answer is I don't know. Analytic solutions for multi-center black holes are not known in ADS, as far as I know, at least not with supersymmetry. We do have orbifold geometries in the sense that, so, and these are Euclidean solutions, so you might say that they're related. So these are orbifolds where not write it, but it's like you start with like thermal cycle that is twice as big and you orbifold the thermal cycle plus the S5. So I don't know even what kind of Lorentzian thing it corresponds to. To be honest, maybe I should say it clearly. All of these are Euclidean solutions. I do not know, besides the basic one, I do not know what any of them corresponds to. They are weird Lorentzian geometries. However, they all contribute to the Euclidean partition function, such that everything conspires together to give the correct result. So I do not know of any other subtles I could compare to, and I do not know and I do not know specifically about multi-center black holes. But there are orbifolds, there are weirder things here. There's thermal ADS, which you can also map. And there are Euclidean deep brains, which you can map. Yeah.
But there could be many more complicated samples that come multiplied by zero, right? And we don't see them in this index, but we will see them in a gen.
Ah, sure, yes. Yes, I mean, part of the annoying thing about all of this thing, and if any of you know how to deal with it, right, is that it all very much relies on the fact that we have supersymmetry. We do not know. So, okay, so maybe let me say one last thing, even though we are very much out of time. So there have been other papers which have looked at this particular setup, but not at the supersymmetric black holes, but the near extreme, near BPS black holes. These are papers by Iliescu and Turiaci and all of that. Their setup is very similar to ours. They're essentially like perturbations around it. So you look at this black hole and you turn on small temperature, if you wish, or slightly breaks the symmetry, and then you can using like two-dimensional gravity result compute the contribution of the dependence on the partition function of the partition function on this small parameter, which is the distance from extremality, and what I want to say is then on the gravity side, you have some handle about the computation you can do, which is not supersymmetric, only slightly near supersymmetric. And there are actual features that they can see using that. So for example, they can argue for a gap in the spectrum between the supersymmetric states and the states above supersymmetry. So there are things they can say about like the spectrum of the theory, where you have like a lot of states in the supersymmetric points, and then a gap of some order 1/n², doesn't matter, and then a continuum. From the gravity side, you can do all of that, and you can access them. This is without any extra subtles. This is just these subtles. From the CFT, I have no idea how to do this computation. I don't know if anybody does, but I think it's a very interesting problem for which we have an expectation. Like we do expect some result. It would be very nice to have some way of arguing that it should happen in the CFT. That's without any extra subtle.
Thanks.